So here's what we have. The king gave the command, and Daniel was brought and thrown into the den of lions. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you faithfully serve, deliver you." A stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, so that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No food was brought to Daniel, or no food was brought to the king, and sleep fled from him. Then at the break of day, the king got up and hurried to the den of lions, and he came near the den where Daniel was and cried out anxiously, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you faithfully serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel then said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they would not hurt me, because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no wrong." And the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. And so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no harm of any kind was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. The Lord always blesses the reading of the Holy Scripture. Well, today we come to the book of Daniel. It is a book that is named after the protagonist of those stories. Daniel is a Jewish prisoner of war. He was captured whenever his city was defeated by the Babylonian army. And he was one of the people that, instead of being killed, he was hauled off to the city of Babylon in order to become a slave of the king. Now, it was a practice of the Babylonian armies, and they were conquering people about 600 years before Jesus was born. That's the time period we're looking at here. It was a practice of the Babylonian armies that whenever they would defeat a group of people, they would look among them and pick out some of the finest young men who were full of promise and full of ability, and they would bring those young men into the court of the king and train them to be the king's trusted slaves and servants. And so it was that young men all over the empire would be selected out to serve the king of Babylon. Now, as you can imagine, the king of Babylon did not want them to continue in their old culture, didn't want them to speak their native language, didn't want them to practice their religions, but wanted them to do as they did in Babylon, practice the Babylonian religion, speak the language of Babylon, eat the food of Babylon. Now, this was a bit of a problem for the young men who were selected from the Jewish kingdom that had just been defeated. Because, as you know, the Jewish culture has certain foods. You're not supposed to eat something if it's not kosher. And there are certain practices and certain faithfulness that you're supposed to show in your religion. So this became a problem more for the young Jewish men than any of the other cultures that had been conquered. And so Daniel and three young men, Jewish men, who were also captured with him, we're going to get to know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in a little bit. They made a deal with the keeper of the slaves that they would not have to eat the Babylonian food, that they could eat only vegetables because the Babylonian food was not kosher. So they made a deal with the keeper of the slaves to try an experiment. For 10 days, these young Jewish men would only eat vegetables, and the other young men could eat all the rich food and all sorts of stuff from the Babylonian court, the royal table. And at the end of 10 days, if the young Jewish men look strong and healthy, then the keeper of the slaves will let them continue their own practices. So for 10 days, the young Jewish men ate only the vegetables, and the rest of the young guys ate stuff off the royal table. And at the end of 10 days, the young Jewish men were stronger and fatter than all of the other young men. Now, I'm trying to figure that out, how you can get fatter by eating vegetables. But I figure maybe they cooked them the way my Grandma Smith did, you know, lots of butter and brown sugar. I don't know how it was, but somehow they ended up looking healthier and more fit to serve. So they were allowed to continue in their traditions. Now, Daniel, it turns out, was also given a strange ability to interpret dreams. He could tell you what your dreams meant. And on one occasion, he also was able to tell King Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was. In fact, there was an occasion when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it was very disturbing to him. It was about this statue made up of different types of materials that ended up crumbling. And he wanted to know what that dream meant, but he also knew that, you know what, his advisors, they just tell him anything. So he said, I want to know who in the kingdom can tell me what my dream means, but in order that I know that you're authentic, I want you to tell me what the dream was. I'm not going to tell you. You have to tell me what my dream was. Well, of course, nobody could do that except for Daniel. The Lord gave Daniel a peek into Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and so Daniel was able to give the interpretation. Now, the hardest thing for Daniel was that he had to look the king in the eye and tell King Nebuchadnezzar, the conquering king of Babylon, that the dream Nebuchadnezzar had was a dream that his empire was about to collapse. So the hardest thing for Daniel was to have the courage to look the king in the eye and tell him the truth. That this thing that he was, the system that he was sitting on top of was about to utterly fail. But Daniel had also not just the ability to interpret dreams, but Daniel was given a gift of courage by God as well. Now, there's another story that takes place in the book of Daniel. It's a book of six stories. The first six chapters of Daniel are six stories. I'll tell you in a little bit what the last six chapters are about. But the first six chapters, six different stories. So we get to the story then of Daniel's friends who had to contend with Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was this king who decided one day that in order to flatter himself, he was going to build this pole that was 90 feet high. And it was going to be gold color. And there was this pole that he was going to erect, and then everybody was supposed to bow down and worship it. Now, at first, it seemed like everybody in the kingdom was really excited to bow down and worship Nebuchadnezzar's thing. But that is everyone except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they were not willing to do this. They were not willing to obey the king's command. So when Nebuchadnezzar heard that there were some people in his kingdom that weren't going to obey him and worship this pole, he had them brought in front of him. He wanted an answer from them why they weren't going to obey the mighty king. And they said, we already have a God. We don't need to bow down and worship this. It's silly. It's ridiculous. We're not going to do it. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was livid, and the text says that his face was distorted in rage. And so he decided that these three young men needed to be punished, and he decided he was going to burn them alive in the furnace. And not only that, he decided he was going to have the furnace heated up seven times hotter than it normally was. And so here's this building, here's this furnace, and it's made of some sort of a stone or brick material, and it's seven times hotter than it normally is, and there's a stairway up the side of it, and you walk up there, and there's the opening, drops down into the furnace below, and he orders his servants to take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up the stairs and drop them in the top of the furnace. And the king, there's a little doorway down below where the king can look through the door, and he can watch these three as they cook in the fire. So now it was such a hot fire that the king's servants, when they took the three young men to the top to throw them in, they were consumed by the flames and died instantly. That's how hot that furnace was. They couldn't even get close enough to drop them in without being killed themselves. So here's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're in the furnace, and the king's looking through the door, you know, to get his revenge, to watch them burn up. And he sees them walking around in there, inside the flames. And he says, and it looks like there's a fourth person walking around who looks like a god. And he says, come out of there. So they walk through the furnace, they walk out the door, and King Nebuchadnezzar is so thrilled at what he's just seen that he bows down and he worships God and he follows all the ways of the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and so forth. Now, this is a little bit like writing it's a burlesque type of writing. It was written years and years after. And Old Testament writers have a way of doing this. They pick some of the most evil characters in history, and they write a story, a satire story about them, on how they just come to love God. And it was sort of a way of poking satire at these public characters. And if you read that story in Daniel, and please read it, it's a funny, funny story. And you get to see how the power of God is expressed really through humor and through satire. Now, after Nebuchadnezzar gets old and isn't able to function as a king anymore, he's replaced by his son, Belteshazzar. And Daniel interprets a dream for Belteshazzar, and the dream is that Belteshazzar is going to he's going to lose his mind, and sure enough, the dream comes true. Belteshazzar loses his mind, and then he gets his mind back again, and then he decides to have a big banquet for all of his officials, and there are these 1,000 people that are in this big banquet hall, and suddenly this strange hand starts writing on the wall, and everybody is terrified as they see the handwriting on the wall. The words are many, many, tekel, parson, and nobody knows what those words mean. And so, of course, the king calls in Daniel, who seems to know everything. He says, what does this mean? And Daniel says, these words mean that your kingdom is about to crumble. The Babylonian Empire is about to come to an end. And sure enough, that night, Belteshazzar was killed, and the Babylonian Empire crumbles, and they are defeated by the Persians, and now there's a new king. So Daniel's warning was true. Not much of a lead on it, but it was true. So the new king, now when the Persians took over, the new king is named Darius, not Darius. I don't know why he mispronounced his name back then. And he also misspells it in all of the Bibles. So if you want to know the correct pronunciation or the correct spelling, talk to our Darius, who will set you straight on that. But anyway, this King Darius of Persia decided that he wanted Daniel to be in his court too. So Daniel, who served the Babylonians, is now serving the Persians. And Darius decides to make Daniel one of his three presidents. Now, we barely can get by with one president in our country, but they have three presidents here now in their country. So three presidents, and you could imagine if there are three presidents, there probably are going to be a lot of politics going on. And sure enough, the other presidents in the Persian Empire decide that they want to get rid of Daniel. So they concoct a scheme where they're going to have Darius give an order that nobody can pray to any other god. And sure enough, Daniel keeps praying to the one true God. And they catch him doing it. And so Darius has been trapped into giving an edict that anyone who prays to another god is going to be thrown into the lion's den. And so that's a story that I read to you. So Darius, who's trapped, he doesn't know how to get out of his own edict that he's issued, ends up forcing Daniel to go into the lion's den, but then he can't sleep all night, and he's delighted the next morning when Daniel has survived. So, first half of Daniel, first six chapters, six wonderful, delightful stories about the courage and the imagination and the strength and the stability of Daniel and his friends. in circumstances that were less than perfect. How do you survive when it seems like you have no power, when it seems like you're just stuck there? How do you survive that? Six wonderful, brilliant stories leading off Daniel, giving us some examples of that. Now, the last six chapters of Daniel, I said they're somewhat different. The last six chapters of Daniel are what we would call apocalyptic meanderings. They are really strange. They're bizarre. They're not really stories. They're just sort of vignettes. And they're written in a strange way. They're written with what we would call the apocalyptic style. Now, the apocalyptic style is something we see apocalyptic writings over a 300 to 400 year period straddling the life of Jesus. And let me give you a couple examples. The most famous apocalyptic writing of the ancient world is the Book of Revelation, which of course ends our New Testament, which is, if you've tried to read it, it's bizarre, it's strange, it uses all sorts of odd things in it. But the first apocalyptic writing, the first real solid apocalyptic writing in history was this second half of the book of Daniel. Let me give you an example of apocalyptic writing here, okay? As I was watching, a male goat appeared from the west, and it was coming across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. So you picture a flying goat, all right? Got that in your mind? And the goat had a horn between its eyes. This, Whitley, you don't raise these kind of goats, do you? All right? I hope not. So you don't raise flying goats? No flying goats. Work on that, okay? Mary Lee? Where's Mary Lee? No flying goats? Okay. Can you work on that maybe? Try it for next year for four. I'm pretty sure you'll win first prize in a state fair. So the goat had a horn between its eyes, and it was coming toward a ram that I had earlier seen standing by the river. The ram did not have the power to withstand the goat. The goat threw the ram down to the ground and trampled upon it, and there was no one who could rescue the ram from the goat. The male goat then grew exceedingly great, but at the height of its power, its great horn was broken, and in its place came up four prominent horns toward the four winds of the earth. Okay, that's apocalyptic writing. You can see that in Daniel 8. That's strange, all right? Or try this from the 10th chapter of Daniel. I was standing on the bank of the Tigris River, and I looked up and saw a man clothed in linen with a belt of gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like beryl, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of the roar of the multitude. Okay, so we get six chapters of this to end the book of Daniel. Apocalyptic writing. It's intentionally bizarre. It's composed of a collage of colors and numbers and animals and angels and battles and dead people coming back to life. And as I said, the fullest example of apocalyptic writing that we have is the book of Revelation that ends the New Testament. But there are traces of it through many books of the Bible. Now, apocalyptic literature flourished in times when people felt most hopeless. That's when we see the most apocalyptic writing. It's when people just felt so overwhelmed by problems that there was absolutely nothing they could do about them. It's in these periods of time that we see lots and lots of apocalyptic writing. When people feel that their problems are too big for even God to handle. And sometimes we feel like that. When people feel that their problems are too big for even God to handle, oftentimes what God does is send a writer who composes scenes with such imagination and audacity that the reader gets fixated on what is being read and you can't get it out of your mind, and that's how God breaks through in moments when we feel powerless and helpless through this imaginative writing. Apocalyptic writing is usually not something, if things are going fine, that we want to read. But when we find ourselves totally helpless, when we find ourselves totally overwhelmed, stuck, unable by our own powers to get out of it, apocalyptic writing comes to us like a rush of the Holy Spirit and just captures our imagination and amps up our imagination, and we are able, through apocalyptic writing, to see and believe again in the work of God. So, the second half of Daniel, apocalyptic writing. Now, the book of Daniel, we also believe, was probably the last book that was written of all 39 books of the Old Testament. We think it was written less than 200 years before Jesus was born. It tells stories of a time 500 and 600 years before Jesus was born. But we think the stories are actually composed satirical comic stories, apocalyptic vignettes. We believe that it was composed while the Greeks were in charge of the Holy Land. Now, throughout Old Testament times, the Jewish people were very seldom in charge of their own lands. There was always somebody else from somewhere else that was in charge, whether it was the Egyptians or the Philistines or the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Persians or the Romans. But a little less than 200 years before Jesus was born, it was the Greeks who were in charge. And the worst Greek king of all was a fellow by the name, and there will not be a test on this, was a fellow by the name of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He was the worst king of all. He brought hogs into the Jewish temple. He killed Jewish people for practicing their religious customs. He did all sorts of evil and despicable things, and he was the most hated king of all, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And we believe that it was during this period of time that Daniel was written, and we have stories of this young man, first six chapters, who was courageous in the face of overwhelming odds, and then we have these apocalyptic writings. We believe that's when this was written. So the apocalyptic part of the book helps stimulate people's hope and their imagination. And that's what we need when we find ourselves just not knowing what to do. We need to have hope. Where's it going to come from? And we need our imagination stimulated. So, as with all these books of the Bible now, what's the bad news of Daniel? What's the good news? What is the practical application of it? The bad news of Daniel is bad news that we still see going on today, and that is that people of power can often cause great destruction, and that's what was happening in the days of Daniel. People who had power were causing a lot of harm to others. People who accumulate power and do it by diminishing everybody else's power they're evil, and they create a great deal of damage in the world around them. That's the kind of damage that Daniel and his friends were experiencing in all of those stories. We experience that same kind of evil in our own lives, where individuals or institutions with great power make the rest of us feel like we don't count, like we are nobodies, or simply irritations on the system. One of the things that my mother taught me when I was growing up was that you don't elevate yourself by putting somebody else down. And she was usually referring to how I treated my brothers. But she taught us all that because she could very clearly see how those things happen, not just in a family, but she could see how those things happen in a church, where you elevate yourself by putting somebody else down. Or she could see how those things were happening in place of work, where you elevate yourself by putting someone else down, or how those things happen in politics or government or in the world that's out there. And so most of us are confronted at one time or another with the challenge that that's not how we should practice power, by putting other people down. But we also know what it's like to be on the receiving end of that terrible thing. And so that's what was going on in the book of Daniel. People in power putting other people down, smashing other people. And what do you do? when you're in a situation like that. So the bad news of Daniel continues to be the bad news of our own day. Now, the good news of Daniel is this, that God gives us gifts when we find ourselves feeling helpless in a situation. And the two gifts that we see coming through in the book of Daniel are the gift of courage and the gift of imagination. I've thought a lot about that because of all of the association that I have with Chinese scholars. In the United States, our culture is a culture that has been informed and shaped by religious faith. The Chinese culture, however, over the last 70, 75 years, has been an intentional atheism where faith is discouraged. And people, in fact, in order to belong to the Communist Party in China, you have to denounce any belief in a God or any belief in a faith. And so it's very interesting to talk with my Chinese friends about problems we have in the U.S. and problems they have in China and how we approach our problems and things that the Chinese have that Americans could really learn from and things Americans have that the Chinese could learn from. Fascinating discussions to be able to talk with these scholars from China. And one of the things that I've noticed is that the Americans have a problem in that it's not just our faith that shaped us. There's been a lot of garbage that shaped us as well. And from our consumeristic culture and our entertainment-oriented culture, and there's not all religion is good religion, and we've been shaped by plenty of the bad religious stuff as well. But the thing that China struggles with is that without any faith at all, one of the things that people almost uniformly lack is imagination and courage, because those are gifts that come to us through faith. And we especially see this in the book of Daniel, where Daniel has courage. If you're in a bad situation and you have no courage, then that's it. There's the end of the story for you. But Daniel and his friends repeatedly have courage. They're not afraid to take risks in the face of the king wanting something different. And the other thing is they have imagination. We especially see that at the end of the book of Daniel with all of these apocalyptic writings. Imagination is so critical because without imagination, there can be no hope. And without imagination, we'll never be able to see the way out. It's only through our imagination that we can get a read on a situation to where we can see a solution that we were never able to see before. So that's the good news, is that God gives us imagination and courage. Almost, they're really supernatural gifts, you could say. The gift of courage, the gift of imagination. So what are the practical applications of Daniel? Three things, really quick. The first thing is that Daniel always manages to find a third way. When he's confronted with an impossible situation, he doesn't just give up. That's the way a lot of people are. Just, well, can't do anything about it. Just go along with it. Daniel doesn't follow that way. He also doesn't follow the second way, which is to try to be like the people who are oppressing him. He doesn't take the path of violence. He doesn't take the path of putting other people down. So Daniel represents a third way. That is all. It's much easier to just be like the people that are the violent ones. It's just easier to be like the people who do the put down. Just be like them, or it's much easier just to give up and say nothing I can do about it. But from the practical understanding of Daniel, Daniel pushes us in a practical way to look for the third way, a way of imagination and courage and creativity. Second practical thing, Daniel introduces us to the concept of what has been known in our own society as civil disobedience. And what civil disobedience means is this, that oftentimes there's a law that's higher than the law of the nation or the law of the state or the law of the government, and that is the law of God. I mean, we say that we are one nation under God. But what that means then, if we really believe that, and we particularly saw it in the South in the 1960s with the introduction of the concept of civil disobedience, we have to understand that sometimes we have to make a choice between the laws of the government and the laws of God. Daniel repeatedly had to make those choices. And the thing that he did was when he chose the way of God, he was also willing to pay the price. He didn't try to weasel out of paying, of facing the punishment that went with that. And this is a fundamental teaching of Martin Luther King as well. Sometimes the law of God is more important than the rule of the county sheriff. But if you're going to follow the rule of God, then you've got to be willing to pay the price that the county sheriff is going to dole out. And we see this with Daniel. So in the book of Daniel, we see the first instance in history of this concept of civil disobedience. And then the third practical thing is the necessity when we find ourselves not knowing what to do next. We're at the end of our rope. We just don't have any, we can't come up with anything on our own. The necessity of humor and imagination. And Daniel teaches us humor and imagination are not just theoretical things. Humor and imagination are important from a practical sense. They are critically important from a practical sense. Because without humor and without imagination, there will be no hope, no joy, no perspective, no ability to see beyond our own feeling sorry for ourselves and our own self-pity. There will be no chance at all to be able to see what God is showing us. And so the practical importance of humor and imagination that comes through so clearly in the book of Daniel. There's going to only be one or two other books where we're going to see that humor, that satire, that imagination. One of the books we'll cover in a few weeks was just going to be the book of Jonah as well. So I'm so thankful for the book of Daniel. I'm thankful for its weirdness. I'm thankful for its sense of humor. I'm thankful for its satire. I'm thankful for how realistic that book is and how it touches on the very things that often discourage us and make us feel helpless in our own lives as well.